Today on Voice of the Public, it's Pet Perspective. And I spent some time this morning looking for some cute little poems about pets. And, well, I think I went through an entire box of Kleenex, especially when I came across the poem that Jimmy Stewart wrote for his dog, Bo, and performed on the Johnny Carson Show in 1981. We'll talk about animal welfare in our community in general, and some of the issues you might be having with your own pets, especially now that we're able to get out of the house a little bit more, and they may not understand why. Veterinarian Dr. Carol Calista and animal advocate Michelle Mounier from Action Programs for Animals join us next, and your questions are welcome at 575-646-2212. We'll begin right after NPR News on KRWG Public Media.
Live from NPR News, I'm Lakshmi Singh. The Biden administration's reducing the size of its infrastructure proposal from $2.25 trillion to $1.7 trillion. It's a counteroffer to Republican lawmakers who've been pushing for hundreds of billions of dollars less. It's unclear if the White House's new offer will have enough backing from Democrats or Republicans. Meanwhile, the White House says the relevant parties have assured the U.S. they're committed to the ceasefire between Israel and Hamas in Gaza. Press Secretary Jen Psaki spoke to reporters today about how President Biden wants to move forward.
He talked yesterday about replenishing support for the Iron Dome, and our view is that saved hundreds of lives, maybe more than that, given the effectiveness. Also to support through the United Nations continued additional assistance in rebuilding Gaza. We've already, of course, restarted our assistance that was ended in 2018.
Israel and Hamas agreed to end 11 days of fighting in the latest cycle of conflict between the two. Both sides claim victory. UN aid groups, meanwhile, have issued an urgent appeal for humanitarian aid in Gaza. At the White House, President Biden presented the Medal of Honor to a Korean War veteran. NPR's Windsor Johnson reports the ceremony is taking place during a visit to the White House by South Korean President Moon Jae-in.
Colonel Ralph Puckett Jr. is being honored for his acts of bravery during the Korean War. The 94-year-old veteran led his unit in fighting off successful waves of enemy counterattacks in November of 1950 that left him gravely wounded. Speaking at the White House, President Biden said Puckett's soldiers were inspired by his leadership and courageous example.
Those men who were there under Lieutenant Puckett's command, they'll never forget his bravery. They never forget that he was right by their side throughout every minute of it.
Puckett retired as a colonel in 1971 as one of the most decorated combat veterans in the nation's history. Windsor Johnston, NPR News, Washington.
Against the backdrop of the coronavirus pandemic, the United Kingdom says it's partnering with the WHO to create a new early warning system for future pandemics. Here's Willem Marks.
British Prime Minister Boris Johnson said a new pandemic radar effort would ensure countries were never again caught unawares, thanks to a new global surveillance system involving rapid viral sequencing and real-time data sharing between different countries. Johnson's asked global health charity the Wellcome Trust to work with other international organizations to monitor future outbreaks and share information about vaccine resistance and viral variants. Wellcome Trust's director said authorities had failed to address similar challenges after other pandemics and action was long overdue. For NPR News, I'm Willem Marks in London.
The Dow Jones Industrial Average is up 154 points since the open. This is NPR News.
Here's a program from our archives. This week, villagers in northern Greece are celebrating St. Constantine's Day in a ceremony that climaxes with revelers dancing barefoot across a bed of hot coals. They carry relics sacred to St. Constantine, and it's said that these holy items protect them from the flames. But is there also a scientific explanation for this phenomenon? I'm Jim Metzner, and this is the Pulse of the Planet. Dr. Kenneth Kilstrom is a professor of physics at Westman College, who's been known to walk across coals himself as a demonstration to his students. He's told us that, aside from faith, St. Constantine's followers have several physical principles protecting the soles of their feet.
There are basically three reasons why it works. The first is heat capacity. If you're baking bread in an oven, if you put your hand in the oven and just touch the air, you don't get burned. If you touch the bread, it feels warmer. But if you touch the side wall of the oven, you burn yourself badly. The difference is that the wall of the oven has a much higher heat capacity than either the bread or the air. And so the first thing that helps is that the coals have a relatively low heat capacity. The second issue is thermal contact, that when you walk on the coals, there's usually a little bit of a layer of ash on them. Basically, the heat doesn't transfer very efficiently from the coals to your feet. You do not want to camp out on the coals. And so generally, you walk reasonably briskly across because the coals are hot. And given enough time, even with the poor thermal contact, the lower heat capacity, eventually it will burn your feet. And it doesn't take that terribly long.
Whether you're carrying icons or a physics textbook under your arm, firewalking is not recommended as a casual pastime. I'm Jim Metzner, and this is the Pulse of the Planet.
Good afternoon, and welcome to Voice of the Public on KRWG Public Media. This is Casey Counts. It is 1:06, and today it's Pet Perspective. And we are joined by veterinarian Dr. Carol Callista. Welcome to KRWG, Dr. Callista. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
And by Executive Director of Action Programs for Animals, Michelle Mounier. Welcome to KRWG.
Thank you, Casey. Thank you for having us.
Well, you know, we have been hearing a lot about how happy our dogs have been over the last year and 3 months or so, because so many of us have spent so much more time at home that for a moment there were theories that dogs were behind the whole thing just to get us to stay home. And now people are going to be venturing out, and certainly have been over the last few months, more and more returning to work, and some getting back to more normal life. And I just thought, you know, our pets might not really understand what that's all about and why we would want to do that. And so I wanted to talk a little bit about what kinds of things we might expect as this change happens. But then there are so many other issues associated with animal welfare in our community. So we'll be talking about some of the things regarding policy that will help our community deal with the problem of so many unwanted animals that are in shelters and rescues like yours, Michelle, and also some of the problems that have developed recently regarding access to veterinary care. Dr. Callista, I know your office has been exceptionally busy. What can you tell us about what has happened over the course of the last year?
Unfortunately, since COVID has hit, our profession has recognized that there is an absolute need for veterinarians in many communities around the country. And we have put out, we've tried to make it as clear as we can on all the resources we can tap, saying we are looking for veterinarians. I know there are other clinics all over the country that are looking for veterinarians so that we can meet the needs of the community. Here in Las Cruces, unfortunately, I think COVID scared a lot of people. Veterinarians have moved away. They have chosen to stop working a little bit. And so we are in dire need of 24-hour care, as people know, here in Las Cruces. And we have discussed trying to meet that need, but we can't get veterinarians.
575-646-2212 is the telephone number to call. If you have a question or a thought you'd like to share along the way today on Voice of the Public, we would love to hear from you. If you're watching along on Facebook, you can also feel free to ask your question or leave your comment on Facebook. Lots of ways to take in Voice of the Public these days, and also by streaming at krwg.org. So thank you very much for however you're listening or watching today. And thank you for participating on Voice of the Public. I want to talk a little bit, Dr. Callista, about how your clinic handled the pandemic. Going back to the beginning, take us through the phases of, you know, realization and how you handled the situation.
Sure. So at the beginning, when none of us thought that this was going to last as long as it has, I came up with a plan where we would split our staff, which we have a fairly big staff, 40 to 50 people, into two groups. And so half the group, you know, we would work every other day kind of thing. So there was no overlap. And if someone on our staff got sick, we would be able to just have the other half of the staff take over. Well, that seemed fine until the first person got sick and then the second group tried to take over. And what we found is that, one, this was going to go on for a lot longer than the 2 weeks that we were willing for the, you know, the second group to take over. And also the fact that this was going to go on for a long, long time. And people were going to get sick. You know, people were going to test positive for COVID here on our staff, which really made a huge impact into us being able to do our jobs as well as we could. So then with time, we joined the groups back together. We put in crazy scrutinous cleansing programs to try to stop, you know, any kind of spread of virus. And over the course of the year and a half now, we have had 8 positive employees. And so every time we have a positive employee, you know, anyone in contact with that employee, you know, we tried to give them those 14 days off. I mean, it has been huge for us. So not only are we shorthanded, but I think, and Michelle can talk about this too, but I think once people realized the pandemic was going to go on for longer, they thought, what a good time to get a pet.
Yeah.
Gonna be home, right? So all of a sudden, out of what we were seeing, because I too agreed. I was like, it is kind of a good idea if you were waiting to get a pet. You can go for walks. You can stay away from other people. But it really put this huge increased, I don't want to say burden because I love what I do, but huge increased number of pets that we were seeing.
Yeah.
With a smaller staff.
And we have a caller on the line now, Michelle, who says, Michelle, you adopted a dog last year and got the first rabies vaccine, but have yet to get the second. What's going on?
Is that question for me?
Oh, I'm sorry. Michelle is on. That's what FB means. I'm communicating here with Mark, the engineer.
Okay.
And I thought Michelle was on the phone. Michelle Prevencio, okay. Who says, OK, so this is a Facebook question.
Okay.
My mistake. Apologies. But what if I adopted a dog last year and it got the first rabies vaccine at the shelter, but I didn't get her the booster? That's the question. Dr. Calista?
So in the state of New Mexico, when we have an unknown history of whether a pet has received a rabies vaccine, the state requires us to booster it after a year. So it's in, and luckily for us, we don't see a lot of rabies cases, but if she got the first vaccine at the shelter last year, when she books an appointment, we would book her then, you know, that pet for a 3-year vaccine. She'd get a new rabies tag and go on from there.
Isn't that the greatest? The new 3-year rabies vaccine. That was a welcome new vaccine to learn about.
Absolutely, that was a wonderful thing, and I think it's really, you know, I worried a little bit at the beginning that maybe people wouldn't be as diligent about getting their pets in because they might follow the rabies vaccine and only let us see them every 3 years. But Las Cruces has really proved themselves to be awesome pet owners, and people still come in when their pets are sick. So,
Michelle, Dr. Calista mentioned that during the pandemic, and that you could probably speak to that, you know, in terms of people adopting more animals. Has that been all positive?
It was positive. I mean, there was that period of time, and I'm trying to remember the time period, that we all had to close for a couple of months entirely, but we were still able to see people by appointment. You know, as long as we were all careful, wore our masks, did social distancing. So during that whole time, people being at home, they would come in and adopt or even offer to foster, you know, when they didn't used to foster animals before because they were home and working from home and able to do so. So for us, as far as on the adoption, you know, center end, it was pretty steady traffic and being able to move animals. You know, one of the things that hurt us as rescues here as well, moving animals along faster, is what Dr. Calista has talked about, which is the lack of, or I guess, not enough veterinarians here to meet the demands. So us rescues have a lot of demands on the local veterinarians too, because we want to fix animals fast, and we want to get them moved on, and it takes time here because there is, you know, very few resources that sometimes it slows our progress down. But overall, during the pandemic, yeah, people were coming in and adopting, fostering, and it was positive for our animals.
Tell us a little bit about the background of Action Programs for Animals and kind of what people need to know about your organization.
Our organization was founded in 2009. We found it under the then kind of largely unknown premise of no kill, which is trying to get your community to save as many of the at-risk lives that go into your municipal shelter as possible. So when we started here back in 2009, our shelter was literally putting down more than 80% of the animals that went in. So our focus was to pull animals from there. So we've been pulling animals from primarily the animal services in the Mesilla Valley nonstop since 2009. So we've saved almost more, we've saved more than 5,000 now. We're very proud of that milestone. And we still mostly pull our large dogs, cats, kittens from the shelter. Although we now work community ones into as we can. And we run an adoption center.
And what is the rate now of animals that have to be euthanized at the shelter?
Now the animals being euthanized at the shelter are less than 20%. So we've literally turned that number completely around and we're rescuing more than 80% in the community. And that's collectively. That's between the shelter, us, and all the other rescues here. We are, you know, I looked at the shelter's 2020 statistics recently. We are their second largest partner in taking animals from them, even among the groups that they have taken from them in other parts of the country. And that's primarily because we take in a lot of kittens during this kitten season.
Ah, yes.
It's here past like 8 months, 9 months, 10 months, you know.
It's basically when the weather gets warm, right?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And you mentioned some of the other shelters in the community. Do you know about how many there are doing the kind of work that Action Programs for Animals is doing?
Well, we have an actual adoption center where we take care of animals there 24/7. The only other facility besides the Animal Services Center is Safe Haven Animal Sanctuary. The other groups pretty much do all that they do out of foster homes. So they foster animals, they either transport them out or they offer them for adoption locally. So there's just a variety of groups here from the largest, we're the largest with Safe Haven, and then going down from there, there's a cat-specific rescue, Cats and Meow, and then many dog rescues that do a lot of great work too. So we all have to do our part to fill niches. People call us to do, like we call street dogs, or there's a scare dog nobody can catch. And the experts in that area are cherished canines. So everybody is out there doing their own parts of the whole no-kill equation is what we call it, providing all the programs and services necessary to either keep animals in their home or either find new homes or positive outcomes for animals that do have to go to the shelter.
575-646-2212, the telephone number to call if you would like to ask a question or share a thought today on Pet Perspective on Voice of the Public. Dr. Calista, I had a thought as you were describing some of the measures that you took at your own clinic and was reminded of a caller who was very concerned about their dog possibly catching COVID, or and was there a concern from the community about COVID and our pets?
Yes, especially at the beginning. You know, we worked very closely with the AVMA, which is our governing body, to really look at the you know, is it possible that you know, pets could possibly carry the virus on their fur, somehow transmit it to person to person? Could the pets get it themselves? And so, you know, there were the biggest lab we work with, IDEX, was offering some, you know, testing for it. Now, after this much time, we feel much more comfortable knowing that that's not possible, because in a, you know, a clinic like ours, where there's a pretty high volume going in and out, in a shelter situation like Michelle has, I mean, we know, because the number of employees that we have that contact all these pets, we would have a huge number of sick employees, you know, including our doctors. And we're lucky that we haven't had that. So, and our governing body says, no. I mean, there are, you know, every once in a while, everybody sees in the news, oh, maybe this dog had it, or maybe this cat had it. But if no one really has been able to say yes or no. And it must be, the incidence must be so low that thank goodness it's not a concern.
I have to mention that just yesterday there was a story out of Malaysia, I believe, where they're starting to look at the possibility of a new coronavirus that they think may have transmitted from dogs to people. So it's just, again, we're in this situation where things are changing and we're learning all the time. So just keeping our eye on those developments that are not only happening here, but also around the world. Because if there's one thing that we learned is that viruses certainly don't respect borders. And
viruses are tricky. You know, viruses are able to mutate. And that's the problem with viruses. So even though I say, you know, no, there's not a problem, we don't see a problem, you know, viruses are always looking for a way to survive. And so what we worry about is if somehow a virus were to have mutated and adapted to allowing a dog or cat to be the vector that would then be able to transfer it to another human or whatever that virus is trying to do. I think that is always possible. In the case, Michelle knows this, of FIP cats, a lot of people are familiar with, that's a virus. It's a coronavirus. It's not the same coronavirus, but it is a coronavirus. And so what happens is many cats have a non-lethal form of coronavirus in their intestine. And in, you know, cattery situations or stressful situations, you know, cats kind of want to be alone, and they will mutate to a lethal form. And so you can have a very benign virus that's kind of living its life. And then all of a sudden, so it's always been a scare to us in the veterinary community, but it's, this whole thing is going to be a scare to us forever.
What are some of the other main health issues that you find in pets in this community?
Probably the biggest thing we see, you know, we have a real problem here with parvovirus. You know, we as the veterinary community, and I'm sure the rescue community, you know, the preventable diseases are the ones that are the most frustrating, you know, when people in with those things, because you think, oh my goodness, if you had just, you know, ABC, mm-hmm. the chance of this, and there's always breakthrough in vaccines and things just like COVID vaccine. But it's very rare, you know, and so, but it comes back down to what Michelle was saying. There is not enough veterinary sort of, numbers to accommodate. I think that the rescue groups do a phenomenal job. And if there were more of us, they could even do a better job because, I mean, we could literally see, I would guess, at least five animals a day, five who, you know, are potentially adoptable. They're trying to get them in. We're trying to serve the needs of the community. How do we balance that? It's very difficult. And I think a lot of the vets in the community are participating, but there's just not enough of us.
Why are we having trouble getting enough vets here locally? Or is it a problem around the country?
Problem around the country. You know, I belong to a Facebook group called the Veterinary Practice Owners, and people talk about it all over. I was reading the other day, someone said, you know, I run a big practice in Southern California. Everybody wants to live in Southern California. I cannot get a veterinarian. And so people are trying, you know, all kinds of incentives. Corporations are offering, you know, huge sign-on bonuses for veterinarians to come. So for clinics like ours that are non-corporate, you know, we're trying to recruit veterinarians to say, look, you know, no, we can't offer you $100,000 sign-on bonus, but this is what we can offer you, and sort of let our small town attitude, you know, sort of bring in the type of veterinarians that we're looking for. But they're just out there.
Is it systemic in terms of, you know, looking at the funnel and young people just not necessarily choosing that career path?
You know, it's interesting because, you know, we have gone to the veterinary schools and said, look, if you have new graduates coming out and, you know, whatnot. And I don't know if you're familiar, but New Mexico has what's called a WICHE program, which is where the state, this is a wonderful thing, will fund part of the tuition, which is quite high for veterinary school now, you know, will fund part of the tuition in return for a payback to the community. And so we just started to kind of go after maybe some of these witchy students that need to go, you know, they have to do a payback. And you know, because we feel like if you just work with us, you're going to love what you see and you're going to want to stay and we'll be able to grow. That's what we hope.
575-646-2212. If you have a question for Dr. Calista or Michelle Mounier, Executive Director of Action Programs for Animals, it's Pet Perspective today on Voice of the Public. And it looks like Kevin is on the line with a question. Good afternoon, Kevin. Thank you for calling.
Hi, thank you very much. I want to thank Michelle for all the great work she and her crew do over there at Action Program for Animals, but I have a question for Dr. Calista. A certain patient of hers has a licking habit, licking rugs, furniture, herself, my bedroom, my bed. And I wonder if it's related to the fact that she barks at anything that moves, whether it's a dog or a person or leaves, trucks. And they both seem to be related to like anxiety, and I wonder if she might have some insight for me.
Before Dr. Calista answers that question, may I ask what kind of dog she is?
She's a yellow lab, and she just turned 11.
And what is her name?
Her name is Roxy Velcro.
All right, Dr. Calista, what do you say about Roxy Velcro?
Well, first of all, I would ask, did you have her since she was a baby?
No, she was 6 years old when I got her, and I think that her neediness was one of the reasons people said they were dumping her.
Okay, so, and has she had that kind of behavior since you had her?
Yeah, at first I thought it was just related to my leaving, you know, like a separation anxiety, but she's good with the separation now. The other two dogs I have kind of calmed it down and let her know that she'll survive and I'll come back. But she still does the stuff. It does seem to have gotten worse. I hadn't really noticed it before. And the barking, yeah, that's, I've been trying to address it. I've tried different commands and, you know, rewarding her for being quiet and trying to distract her. I've used a bark collar, which she seemed to enjoy.
Well, first of all, you say that, you know, even though I always encourage people to adopt those older babies who have been, you know, turned in and abandoned for some reason. But the same kind of problems that with, you know, children that unfortunately maybe have not been in the most stable home for the first years of their lives, you know, research shows that that causes, you know, actual changes in the brain oftentimes. And so trying to work with that, whether it be with the child or with the dog, is sometimes very difficult because, you know, you're trying to reverse basically maybe some PTSD that dog has, you know, sort of unfortunately gained because of experiences. And, you know, that hypervigilance that dog has, you know, has to come from something. I mean, sure, there can be, you know, mental conditions, just like with people, where there may be, but most of the time from those rescues, don't you agree, Michelle, something has probably happened that really made that poor baby. I'm glad she's in a stable home. I'm glad she has you and, you know, she's got her little pack and that helps. But one more thing before I let Michelle get in on this, because she has a lot of experience with these older rescues, is as they get older, now you take that personality and you start to lose your sight a little bit. You start to lose your hearing a little bit. Maybe when you move a way, you're painful and that stimulates something. You don't understand it. Nobody can tell you why you're feeling that way. And they become a little worse because they're frightened. They're frustrated and they're frightened.
So there's not much to do except be patient with her, I guess.
Well, I was going to say, let me let Michelle put her two cents in there, though, with patients that, you know, pets that she's seen. I'll try to give you some ideas of maybe some suggestions.
Yes, because in a rescue, when we see pets with either behavior issues or fearful issues, people always assume they were abused or something. And that's not always the case. There are those formative first months of their life, that they say the first 4 to 6 months really form that personality they have. And obviously, she's very anxious. I would say try to maybe look for some natural ways to remedy her anxiety. But it is hard because they can't talk to you and they can't tell you how they're feeling. So we always tell people the second thing is to have them checked out very well by your veterinarian and see if there are like maybe some medications that might help. When we get some of the dogs out of the shelter, they are super. We do like, we target the dogs that have been in the shelter the longest time. So they come out sometimes very skinny, very, very, they haven't been out of a kennel for a year. They're just jumping off the walls. Many times our vets will work with us to do some types of medications, even Prozac sometimes to start getting them back, you know, to a normal way of being. So it just depends, I guess, on the dog.
I agree with Bellamy. We are able to use, there's a lot of natural supplements. We always try to do that kind of thing first. You know, we use, you know, calming supplements. There's a lot of, can you still hear me? I'm going to lose the power on this phone, I think, if that happens.
Yeah, we need a charger for you, but we can see you and we can hear you.
Okay. You can't?
We can.
Oh, okay. Let me finish and I'll step out for a second. Is that, yes, we use everything from, you know, we use a product called Compro. It's like a natural supplement that helps. People are using, there are foods available, calming foods that have tryptophan in them, like the sort of sedate feeling you get after you eat too much turkey at Thanksgiving. And then, of course, like Michelle's saying, we use everything from Prozac to Xanax to, you know, Ativan to Clonopin to anything that we can to work closely with people, because we feel it's bad for the pet to feel that way. Who wants to feel like that? To feel like right. Something moves, you've got to.
A brand name Pet Naturals calming thing. It's over the counter that I get. And I've been giving her, spread out over time, 3 tablets a day. And it, I haven't noticed any impact, but she loves eating them.
And it's just people, you know, you have to try different things until we find, you know, some kind of supplement. And one of the things we do is, you know, when we try products through the hospital, one of the reasons we don't charge for recheck exams is because I have people try something like this. I'll say, I'll see you back in 2 weeks. We don't charge another exam. We do another product. I'm like, how's it going now? Let's try another, you know, until we hopefully find.
Well, yeah, thank you, Kevin. We appreciate the call and, you know, good luck. Obviously, she's getting on up there in years. And if she likes eating those treats, then 575-646-2212 is the telephone number to call. Dr. Calista is running off to go find a charger. And so in the meantime, she just made it back, because we do have another caller on the line that I want to get to. Actually, a couple that are holding. So, Carol, you're on the line now on Voice of the Public. Hi, how are you?
Oh, fine. And you?
Good, thank you. What's on your mind?
Well, I really appreciate this program. Well, there's just two things. One is an observation. We live outside of town 15 miles south, and we see animals literally dropped off on the ditch, you know, behind our houses. And they don't have chips. When you take them to the vet, they haven't been vaccinated or spayed or neutered, nothing. And, well, we don't know about vaccinated, but in any case, it's a common problem. You probably know it. I'm just sharing it. We had a kitten just recently sit and cry outside our door until it finally came to us. And ultimately, we gave it to one of the people at our vet's office. So I think it's a common problem. I saw a man drop off 3 teeny little dogs once. People just dump their animals.
Carol, yeah, we haven't even really ventured into that whole topic of conversation just yet, but we are definitely going to. But let me get Judith, because poor Judith has been third in line here waiting for some time with a question on Voice of the Public. Good afternoon, Judith. Thank you for calling.
Well, thank you for having me. My husband and I just want a few seconds to give tribute, really, to Dr. Alice Bauman, who is retiring from Dr. Kalista's practice. She has given our small cats such wonderful care all her life, for which is 11 years, and we just want to thank her publicly.
Oh, that is awesome. Let me just tell you, Dr. Bauman has been a huge asset to this practice, and you say she's retiring, but she's taken a little time off, and let me tell you, we are going to drag, cannot not do this for a living. She will have something lost from her life, so don't you worry, she will be back.
All right. Thank you so much, Judith, for the call. 575-646-2212 for your question or comment today on Voice of the Public. It's Pet Perspective with Dr. Carol Kalista and Michelle Mounier, the Executive Director of Action Programs for Animals. So, Michelle, let's dive into the topic of, you know, the unwanted animals in our community, why we have this problem, and how do we fix it?
So earlier, you and I were kind of talking about this, and what happens in a community like ours, where we're reaching that no-kill goal, which is saving more than 90% of the animals that go to the shelter, is the ones left to save, it is the hardest cases. And we're needing to look at the data. So recently, you know, we get stuck in rescue. We're stuck in the trenches, really, of this work. We have to come up sometimes and look at the big picture again. So I recently got intake shelter data from the Animal Services Center, trying to see what's left, who's coming into the shelter, where are they coming from? And the primary places they're coming from are zip codes 88007 and 88011. And those are those outlying areas in our community where people are doing dumping of animals. And with COVID, there was a lot of people would find an animal and call us. Well, we're not the shelter. We don't have the big capacity. We don't have the millions of funding that, you know, a shelter gets to be able to absorb all those animals. And then they were being told that if they weren't sick or injured, they couldn't be accepted at the animal services. So there was this whole period of time, I don't know if it was worse during 2020 because of COVID, where do people, what do people do with animals that they find? So there is that.
It was awful.
Where it's kind
it
of,
was terrible.
It was terrible because no one could fit them in, and people were either having to take them home or let them go loose. And it's just, you know, that was also, 2020 was a very strange year. So we're going to have to keep looking at data after COVID and before and see if those areas are still the problem areas. So, you know, we have to look at that data, because as we get close to saving more lives, you're left with a bunch more cats and kittens because we still haven't properly implemented TNR in our community. And then you're looking at dogs that have either problems, like behavior problems, or sickness or injury that people can't afford, and that's why they're ending up at the shelter, or they're escape artists, or, you know, they're not the easiest ones to save, and they're not the ones that people in other communities will want on these transport flights, because they want, you know, your friendly, your very highly placeable animals. They don't want the problem animals either. So what do we do with them? How do we rehab them, and how do we place them in homes? It's getting more challenging.
I follow a lot of animal pages, and I often see people who will say, post something like, I would like to adopt, but I can't afford the $75 adoption fee at the shelter. And so I want to respond, then you can't afford a pet.
Right.
Because we never know what kind of medical needs that pet, you know, will eventually face. And we probably all can relate to that, and those surprise happenings along the way that are not inexpensive to deal with. But how do we get the message out, and what efforts are being done in the community to get the message out to people to spay and neuter, so that, you know, we can attack the problem at its source?
And that comes back to what Dr. Kalista was talking about, is the veterinary services here, and even the shelter is trying to hire another vet to provide public spay and neuter like they used to at a low cost, because the demand is there. if APA had, you know, the money to bring in a vet and set up a clinic at our place, it would literally be busy every day fixing animals, whether owned animals or feral cats. The demand is there. It's just we can't seem to match it right now. And that's part of the challenge for our leaders is how do we attract and bring more veterinarians to work at the shelter, to work at the clinic, so that we can meet those demands more. So it's a problem for all of us.
Yes, I agree 100%. I always have said when I first moved to Las Cruces, it was amazing to me how many lay people, you know, non-veterinary, were so committed to the problem that we have here with overpopulation and with the problem pet, if you will, being given up and no questions asked. And I have always, you know, after being here for almost 30 years, I have always thought it would be wonderful if we could open up a little satellite that was, you know, it would be somewhat, you know, it'd have to be somewhat abbreviated, but we would just basically have somebody spaying and neutering all day. If people came in and they, you know, sort of a clinica kind of thing, like kind of a lower cost sort of thing, you know, we have, you know, liability to worry about, you know, somewhat, but people would know if they're going there, you know, it's palliative care. There's a lot of people in this community that so love their pets, so committed to them. Homeless people, some of our homeless people are incredibly committed to their pets, and we try to help them, but healthcare is expensive. The products are expensive, you know, the drugs are expensive. And, you know, even if we, you know, try to, you know, we try to bend when we can, but gosh, it does. And as the pet gets older, the cost of healthcare, you know, goes way up, and people want to do things. Plus veterinary medicine has become more sophisticated. So now we do chemotherapy, we do stem cell therapy, we do these major surgeries. And a difficult thing for me is to say to someone, yes, I can fix this essentially, or I can manage this. And the person says, and I know that it will come out okay, or I really think chances are, but the person says, you know, $100 may be $1 million to me. And then what do you do? And so do they give up that pet? Sometimes they do. And they take them and I can't do it, hoping that somebody else will adopt that can afford it. I mean, it's a huge problem. And I think part of it stems from if we had many more veterinarians in the community, the needs are not being met. They're just not. And everybody, like our clinic, we're like, okay, bring them, we'll try. Okay, bring them, we'll try. You know, and it's just hard. It's very hard.
It's been awesome to watch, you know, as we have gone through this pandemic and all of the staff there, no matter how hot it is or cold it is outside, and here they come buzzing back and forth. So, but Heidi's on the line, has been holding Heidi from Silver City Humane Society. Did I get that right, Heidi?
Yes, you did.
Welcome to Voice of the Public. Thanks for calling.
Thank you. I have a comment about spay and neuter, but first let me ask my question. You know, when people adopt from us about 2 to 3 weeks afterwards, I call them up, you know, to do a follow-up and check on how things are going. And the number one question that I get is difficulties with potty training. And I have a couple of recommendations that I make, but I would like to hear from your two guests what recommendations they have of some of the best ways to potty train.
Well, let's hear what you say first.
Well, I always, of course, do a positive reinforcement, and I've even recommended that, you know, if an animal has an accident in the home, to pick it up, whether it's liquid with a tissue or a poop, and pick it up, take it outside to where it is you want them to go, and put it down there, and then get very excited and reward them, showing them that it was a good thing that it was outside, and never scolding. Of course, I have a pet door, which has made things very, very easy. You know, I push them out the pet door and then cheer and laugh and make it a wonderful experience, and they learn very quickly to go outside. But that's probably the primary thing that I suggest. Of course, always positive reinforcement.
Well, I've never heard that before, Heidi. Thank you. I'm going to try that. I got a dog door, too. It helped with the poo situations, but we've still got the number ones to deal with. Michelle, why don't you go first?
That's a big problem. People always want, you know, a perfectly potty trained dog, and we can't guarantee it. I mean, we have small dogs and fosters that we can tell them where they're at with it, but to guarantee 100% potty training is impossible. And then when they go to a new place, you have to reinforce it. And the caller is right that positive reinforcement is best. We even have that as a disclaimer on our adoption contract that you're not going to use punitive old-fashioned potty training techniques on the animals, so we can go over it with people, because that'll set them back even further, like sticking their nose in it, spanking them. That totally confuses them. They don't understand and they just get scared. So you have to take them out frequently. Take them outside after they eat, after they nap, kind of like, you know, when they're babies, when they're puppies, and reward them when they're outside. That said, I have an American bully that Dr. Calista might remember that she saw that I adopted from APA, because she still goes in the house. And even with a dog door, she's never completely learned. And I don't know if that was because she was used for excessive breeding and she has an issue. It could be also medical. So especially with cats, if suddenly they're going in the litter box and then they stop, you should get them checked medically, because there could be a medical reason.
Yes, I agree with both people entirely that the school of thought has changed. It used to be many, many years ago, it was a negative reinforcement type of thing. And now, you know, the behaviorists say absolutely not. Everything should be positive. You know, you make a big deal when they, you know, do what you want them to do. What a good baby. And using commands so that they know, you know, go potty or, you know, go pee. Hi-ya. Or. Yeah. And then some kind of a big reward, whether it be, you know, jumping up and down because that positive praise is so important, or whether it be, you know, a little treat so they know. But the other thing is, I think really, really watching the behavior, like Michelle said, when the behavior changes, if your dog gets up from sleeping, most likely they're going to have to go to the bathroom within a very short time of that behavior change. And so when people are home with them with little puppies, I tell them, don't wake your puppy up to go to the bathroom. Watch that dog when they get up. Let's go potty. Let's go potty, buddy. You know, we go outside, they go to the bathroom. Big deal. What a good boy. What a good boy. I think people sometimes now it's 3 a.m. You know, you got a little bit, but don't change the behavior that they're doing so that they can go to the bathroom. But once they get it and you assign a command like go potty, you know, so now you're taking a drive to Albuquerque. A lot of those babies, you teach them very quickly. You get out of the car, you have 20 seconds, you're like, go potty, baby. Okay, back in the car, here we go. And they get the idea and make that relationship.
All right.
But I think people get...
That's one of the things I really stress, too, is making sure that you always use the same command, whatever it is, whether it's go potty or let's go outside or do you need to tinkle or whatever it is, just make sure you're consistent with the command, because that's what they learn, is the command. That's some great info that I will definitely use. And then just real quick, I just had a comment about the spay and neuter, because one of our biggest problems in our community, you know, we have funding available. We have a good supply of veterinarians here, but we still deal with the individual who says, oh, I don't want my male dog to give up his masculinity. And that's our big stumbling block, is how do we get people past that? I mean, we've offered to pay for it. We have clinics. We have all this stuff going on, but they still won't do it because of that.
What has worked, if anything? Dr. Calista, you raised your hand.
Yeah, I think that is, you know, again, when I first moved here, I thought that was quite a big problem, because people would say that. And sometimes we'd neuter the pets and we put the false little testicles in there because people wanted to see that. And, you know, I don't know about that, but I think the problem is a little worse now. And I'll tell you why, because from the medical standpoint, the school of thought has changed now. So it used to be that we would say to people, I have posters, if you've come in my exam rooms, that talk about why we should spay early. It looks at the percentages of dogs who develop mammary cancer. So we still push that. But now the research is showing that in male dogs, in large male dogs, that maybe you don't want to neuter them early because there's a higher incidence of cruciate ligament tears in those dogs. Well, the community now has heard this. And so sometimes I have
you know, pets come in that I'm like, well, you know, we used to say after the last vaccine, we like 2 to 4 weeks and then let's neuter and spay right away. And we try to schedule that appointment right away so that there's that continuity, you know, oh, it's been 2 years and I forgot to call. We tried it. But now people say, you know, I read that you should wait with a male dog because there can be more problems. And I don't want to lie and say, oh, what are you talking about? We say, yes, let's talk about that with large breeds of dogs. So unfortunately, we as veterinarians fear this a little bit, that it might get a little worse because people think they should wait. And in some cases, I can't tell them not to.
And who knows, but you might have seen my face. I kind of jaw dropped when you said that. I've got a 150-pound cane corso who got neutered at about 8 months at the shelter. And then by two, he had torn cruciate ligaments. And I thought, oh my gosh, this recovery is going to be so so difficult because he's 150 pounds.
Right, right. And it's interesting because when the literature first started coming out and I saw it, I thought, we just see a lot of cruciate tears. And I think that's probably just because, you know, people are very active with their dogs. And, you know, we tend to, our dogs, not all of them, but tend to be a little overweight. They got a little spindly legs, kind of a big body. It goes, you know, there's reasons that you tear, you know, the ligaments in your knees. But now that those statistics are coming out, I have stepped back and thought, do I see that? Because we do that surgery, you know, do I see that? And I'm not sure yet, but that really is a problem for the, what we're talking about, for the people not, because now you might have, till those growth plates close, a year and a half to 2 year period of time where maybe he gets out and you know, it's not your fault, you're not irresponsible, but things happen. And now you've contributed to the overpopulation.
Wow, that's interesting. Thank you for sharing that information. And Heidi, thank you for your call. Next on the line is Margaret, who has been waiting patiently. Thank you, Margaret, for calling Voice of the Public. How can we help you today?
Well, thank you. And Dr. Callister is my veterinarian, and she's a wonderful veterinarian. And I have, well, I have a question that is related to two dogs, basically, but for different reasons. So Dr. Callister has met my little rescue, Fiona, who is not so little anymore. And she's a wonderful dog. She loves everybody. Dogs come to the yard, and she plays nicely. You know, just absolutely super dog. However, if I take her on a trail on the leash, and she's always on the leash, when we pass... Not, and it doesn't always happen, but when we pass people, dogs, or both, she sometimes gets very aggressive and starts barking at them, and it looks as though she wants to bite them. I mean, I don't think she does. I think she just wants to go and say hello to them, but I'm not convinced. And so the way I have been dealing with it is to take her away from the situation. Sit her down, calm her down, treat her, and all the rest of it, which basically works, but I still haven't really overcome the problem. And I'm wondering if you have any suggestions of how else I can deal with it.
Well, first of all, hi, Margaret. I recognize your voice.
I wonder why.
How are you? that is a huge problem. I didn't know that she did that. That is a huge problem because, you know, I'm sure she, you know, I haven't seen her in a little while now, but I'm sure she's much, much bigger. And I can just see her pulling you over and dragging you down the street as she tries to go after another dog. And maybe Michelle can help with this too. But what I know of that situation really is what you're doing. Again, you do that distractive behavior. So you try to take her away from that focus, which seems to be our be all and end all, which is chasing that dog across the way. And you move it to something, you know, people do clicker training, for example. So when the dog hears the clicker, you can buy them on Amazon and they automatically focus on you. And they focus on you because whatever happens when you do the clicker is so positive. I had a behaviorist one time call it the jackpot. So when they get the jackpot, whether it be a piece of filet mignon or whatever it is, when they get that clicker, they so want that jackpot that it distracts that behavior, if you can find a jackpot.
I do have a clicker. I've never actually used it. I'm never quite sure how to use it, but that would be a good idea. And then I've got these special treats, you know, which are beef jerky or whatever they are for dogs, and which you really like. So maybe the combination of the two. But the main problem is that I can't actually walk close to people, which I would like to be able to do. Do you think eventually that I will be able to do that?
Well, I think it would have to be baby steps, real baby steps, you know. Right. You know, I personally, many years ago, had a very large German Shepherd who wasn't very people-friendly, and I was working with a trainer who said, okay, I think we're ready to walk from the beginning to the end of the downtown mall during the, the market. By the time, uh-huh. You know, and there's... Oh, going along. By the time I got to the end, I thought I was going to have to be hospitalized, you know, because it's frightening.
Yeah.
But I would work with a trainer. I would get with somebody, you know, I can give you some suggestions. I don't know if I'm supposed to do that kind of over there. But if you want to call me, call my phone. I have a great trainer here in town that works very well with things like that. And she would work with you, you know, one-on-one, because, you know, it's not as enjoyable, you know,
no,
to have a dog.
It's not. I mean, you know, 95% of the time, she's wonderful. And I don't know quite why she does it. I mean, she was a rescue, and I got right. her at about 5.5 months old. I don't think she's had any terrible experiences.
Margaret, if I could just jump in here, because believe it or not, we're like almost out of time. I can't believe this hour has flown by so fast.
Oh, yes, that is a shame. Yes.
I had a similar situation with a dog that, you know, it was that I learned about kind of leash aggression. And Michelle, what can you add to that?
Yes, yeah. I was about to say it happens in rescue a lot because they can be leash aggression, also barrier aggression. So when you're passing by a dog kennel and they're barking, barking, barking and look really aggressive, you think, oh my God, that dog's really aggressive, but it's really not. It's just the barrier, the leash causing it. So you would have to work with a trainer very well and get that dog out there and socializing around people. It's just a matter of undoing that response. And part of what Dr. Callista said too, we run the prison program too, training dogs at the Southern New Mexico Correctional Facility. And those guys there sometimes use a vibration collar. So it's not a shock, but it's a vibration that kind of gets them, like we had a deaf dog they had to train. So they had to use a vibration collar to train her to come back, to recall, because she can't hear come back. So they use the collar to teach that. So you can maybe do that to also get her focus off when she's going, you know, you have to try to catch it at the right moment too. So that's the key, that a trainer can help you catch it right before it happens.
Right. And one thing I noticed with my dog is that, because we would go to the dog park off leash in the dog park, there's no aggression at all. So it was definitely tied to that. And I wanted to give you an opportunity, Michelle, before we actually do run out of time and hit that hard mark, because you brought some resources with you today and to share with folks about some folks that they might be able to make contact with for some help in those areas.
Sure. I mean, I'm interested in who Dr. Callista was talking about, too. But like Cloud Canine here does training classes at the Doc Diving Center, the Canine Doc Diving Center. Online, like YouTube, you can look at Kiko Pup. There's, you know, videos that show some of the basics. The Whole Dog Journal is really a good resource if you have questions or issues with either this or, you know, health matters. So those are just some of the places that we recommend for people. And our own PAWS trainer has her own page if anyone wants to, or her own resource online training if anyone wants to contact us about that.
Yeah, I agree. I think that what Michelle is talking about, yes, I think those are some excellent resources. And then, of course, you know, there's kind of the step up. I mean, sometimes people have behavioral problems that do require, you know, a veterinary behaviorist. And we do that. We can do it consult now through telemedicines. We do it through some of the veterinary schools to try to help with, you know, some of the bigger problems. I mean, we have people who their own dogs bite them. You know, you can't lift away. That's not enjoyable. You need to have a relationship, you know, a partnership with your pet or your cat, the same thing. People have many behavioral issues with cats. And so yeah, I think that there are people who are really good at it and they're very into it and they really have improved the relationship between the pet and the person.
A friend of mine used to say, how come you see lions and tigers doing tricks in the circus, but you never see house cats?
Yeah, right.
But there are some folks that have managed to do that, as a matter of fact. And I believe there's one gentleman who adopts shelter cats and then teaches them all. He says, I just let them tell me what tricks they like to do. And then we go on the road and perform. Well, with the 1 minute that we have left, as we head into here in the summertime, the summer months, obviously we start talking about heat and our pets. And so, Michelle, what message just do you want to get out there as we start to see those triple-digit temperatures in our near future?
Definitely. You need to safeguard your pets during the hottest time of the day. You can't take them in your car and leave them in your car. Remember, cars can get very hot. They can suffocate and die in them within minutes. And if they're outside, you need to provide plenty of shade and water. But preferably they have a dog door like mine and they just come lay under the air conditioner vent.
Well, Michelle, thank you so much for taking some time to be with us today.
Thank
we appreciate
you.
Having you. And Dr. Calista, thank you as well so much. I know your schedule has been incredibly busy, so we appreciate it. We're going to have to do it again soon because there was so much I know that we just didn't get to today.
Well, thank you very much for having us.
And coming up next on KRWG, it's NPR News, and then Intermezzo by Request with Leora Zeitlin. Thank you for joining us on Voice of the Public for Pet Perspective.